89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. Please stay tuned for Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
We're not dealing with a real threat. We're dealing with an artificial threat. We're dealing with a fake terrorism. 9/11 and most of the terrorism that goes on in this world today is, in fact, fake terrorism or contrived terrorism, false flag terrorism. And that the war on terror, which is what 9/11 was meant to start, is equally a fraud. The war on terror and the terrorism that we see happening around us is all part of basically a big feeder operation, a big psyops. And so when we understand that, we can disabuse ourselves of this notion that we're fighting a war against Islam and the whole Arab world, what have you. No, we're being duped. We're being deceived on a day-to-day basis.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Christopher Boleyn. Today's show, Architects of Terror. Christopher Boleyn is an independent researcher, investigative journalist, and author. Upon graduation from high school in Cook County, Illinois, he spent the next 3 years traveling extensively throughout Europe and the Middle East, finally settling in both a kibbutz in Israel and in Norway, where he studied Egyptian, Biblical Hebrew, and Norwegian at the University of Oslo. He is a graduate of the University of California in history with an emphasis on Israel-Palestine. Along with research and writing, he has worked as an editor and translator. His travels and studies of German, Spanish, Norwegian, Swedish, Hebrew, and Arabic languages have helped him analyze international politics and events. He is the author of Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and Solving 9/11, The Articles. Christopher Boleyn, welcome again.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
In Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, you have a chapter entitled The Architecture of Terror, Mapping the Network Behind 9/11. This chapter includes a dizzying array of connected companies and people, both in and out of government, that were in positions to facilitate and orchestrate the events of September 11th. You met with Andreas von Bülow, the former head of the Parliamentary Commission that oversaw the financing of the German intelligence agencies. What did von Bülow have to say about what he termed as a, quote, sophisticated false flag operation like 9/11?
Well, the first thing he told me was, this was in November or early December 2001 in Germany. He told me that, first of all, he suspected that Israeli intelligence was behind the 9/11 atrocity. And then he said that such a sophisticated operation, a false flag operation, would involve three different levels. The first level, he said, was the architectural level. This is the people who planned the false flag crime in order to have it blamed on a third party. In this case, you know, the Arab Muslims, fanatics of Osama bin Laden. And the purpose of their false flag terrorism is to basically change public opinion. In this case, change U.S. public opinion to support the war agenda in the Middle East and to support the increased defense spending. The second level, he said, was the managerial level. These are the people who managed the setting up of the crime and then managed the deception that follows the crime. And they also, this managerial level, control the third level, which is the working level. And, for example, he said the working level is part of the deception. In this case, the working level would be, for example, the 19 Arabs, the alleged hijackers.
Did von Bülow have anything else to say about his opinion of this operation?
Yes, well, it was surprising that he said, quite frankly, that he thought it was an Israeli operation, Israeli intelligence. And I went ahead and reported that in the report that I wrote up about our discussion. And he was surprised because he had said the same thing to German journalists, but as he said, that none of the German journalists would ever publish such a statement. but I did. And he was a little bit surprised at that, you know, our media or the paper I wrote for would go ahead and say such a thing.
You write that there is evidence of an Israeli intelligence network connecting every key player and entity behind 9/11. The people and companies and their interrelationships are quite complex. Can you talk about a few of these networks, the people and companies?
Yeah, well, like you said, there's a host of them. Ehud Barak, for example, when he lost the election to Ariel Sharon, came over to the United States in the late winter of 2000. And was working in the United States, you know, for the 10 months or so prior to 9/11. And he worked with a company that was actually produced aluminum nanoparticles, nanocomposites, which is one of the key elements of nanothermite. And then there was, as you said, in that Chapter 7, The Architecture of Terrorism, there's a whole host of companies, you know, including NICE NICE, that's an Israeli company, and others. And as I found, as I demonstrate in this chapter, these Israeli companies are all interrelated, interlinked with, for example, the scores of Israeli art students who were spying on and trying to set their stuff up in DEA offices across this country. These companies and these relationships were actually investigated after I wrote the chapter by an English editor and a fact checker, and he examined 105 statements that I made in that chapter and found that all of them were correct. And this was a person in England who was actually hostile to my thesis that this was an Israeli operation, but he was hired by a publisher in Europe to check the facts of that chapter that you referred to, The Architecture of Terrorism, and found that all of my connections, all of my statements were in fact true.
Yes, that chapter is very complex. It was hard for me to hold it in my mind all at once because there's so many interconnections and a huge cast of characters. Now, you mentioned the art students. This is a very important point. You go into that in some detail in your book. What can you tell us about these art students? Who do we think they might have been?
Well, That's a really interesting. These art students were Israelis who pretended to be art students. And actually, though, I think it was the DEA had done a working paper, an analysis of these students who had been arrested and who had been caught, and found that they were actually Israeli military personnel, active, who had served in or were members of demolition units. Many of them, like there was a Per Segelovitz, I think his name was, who was one of the heads of these teams, and he had led a platoon or a group of like 80 other soldiers, and their specialty was in fact demolition. And these people were the ones who were, you know, found trying to infiltrate into DEA offices, Drug Enforcement Agency offices, and private homes of agents of the DEA across the United States. And this when this information came out, this was also part of the Carl Cameron four-part series on Fox News that came out just after 9/11. But there's a tie-in. These individuals in this Israeli art student spying operation were connected to Israeli companies that were, you know, also tied into 9/11. As you said, it's very complex. It's what I've done is I've created a flow chart sort of thing where I have mapped out these entities and show the relationships between them. And what Israeli intelligence has done for a long time, actually, in this country, in the United States, is that they set up a company in Israel. The research and development of the company is done in Israel, and they create the headquarters or business office for that company in Menlo Park, California, or Silicon Valley, or Boston, or what have you. And so it has the appearances from the outside of being an American company when, in fact, it is an Israeli intelligence operation 100%.
Now, you just said that these Israeli art students, so-called, at least some of them, were arrested. What were they arrested for?
Well, they were arrested and caught when they were very aggressively trying to get into or they're harassing DEA offices and DEA personnel at their private residences. And so the DEA document lists the names, sometimes the spelling isn't quite correct, of these agents as they were caught, as they were observed, trying to basically infiltrate DEA offices across the country. And this was going on in I think it was in Texas and California and a lot in Florida. Most of the activity was actually being done in Florida, right around the area where these 19 alleged hijackers lived.
Well, now, do you have any opinion as to why they would be trying to infiltrate the DEA? I mean, now, there is evidence that these 19 or how many ever accused hijackers that were living in Florida were actually dealing drugs. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that could very well be. And the thing is that what we also know about the alleged hijackers, the 19 Arab alleged hijackers, is that many of them had been issued duplicate licenses. And when you read the details, you find that, you know, for example, one of the Arab hijackers would get the license on a Wednesday, and the very next day a call would come into the DMV, what have you, the people who issue licenses in Florida, requesting a duplicate license issued and with the excuse that the person had moved to a new residence and had a new address. So what you have is you have basically two IDs for the same person in circulation at the same time. And this is an indication that, and many of these people had also reported having lost their passports. So what this indicates is that there were two people going around with the same ID, leaving basically a false trail in the name of the person who was to be implicated in the crime. So that's a Mossad operation tactic that's been used for a long time, and it's very well described in the book by John Le Carré. He wrote a book in 1982 called The Little Drummer Girl, and it's about a similar Israeli terror operation in Europe. George Roy Hill made a film about it, but the book explains how this is done, how a false trail is left to implicate a person in a crime. And that's what we have. That's apparently what we had with these 19 alleged hijackers. Somebody was leaving a trail in their name to implicate them in the crime. And as you say, why would the Israelis be interested in infiltrating and getting into DEA offices? Probably because they were trying to do intelligence gathering on the DEA. And what I see is that the Clintons and the Bush families have been involved in this drug operation that began back in the 1980s, you know, in between the Medellin cartel, and the Israelis were involved in this. So having access to the DEA offices and the information would give them the power, especially with this computer enterprise software, to know what is going on in the DEA at any given time in real time. That's what they probably wanted.
And how would that information have benefited them?
Well, the thing is that, as I point out in the chapter of the planes of 9/11, the second chapter of the book, Solving 9/11, the Israeli Aircraft Industries, IAI, has long had a base in Bogota, Colombia. And I believe, and I think the evidence is pretty clear, that the Israelis have been involved in this drug operation from Colombia to the United States, along with the Bush family and the Clinton family. And nothing ties people more closely together than a crime committed together. And I think that the crime here is this, that they basically took over the Medellin drug cartel operations. And this is, I think, why Philip Marshall was killed in Calaveras County a year or so ago, because he had written a book called Lakefront Airport. And he writes about his experiences. It's an autobiographical novel in which he writes about his experiences being the personal pilot, the Learjet pilot, for Barry Seal. And Barry Seal was, of course, the drug smuggler who turned to be a DEA informant. And this is what, this is the crime where these families are connected. The operation that, was being run out of the White House, out of the basement of the White House by Papa Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush. And Bill Clinton was, of course, the governor in Arkansas when Barry Seal was flying all this massive amounts of cocaine into Arkansas. And what the problem is for them is that this pilot, Philip Marshall, knew the names, knew the places, knew the operation, and had written a book about it. And he was planning to write a fourth book. But the third book, Lakefront Airport, is very hard to get. Right now, if you want to buy it on Amazon, it costs about $600. But I just read it, and you can see very clearly that it's his inside knowledge of this drug operation, weapons and drug operation called, the Iran-Contra thing, that's what put his life in danger, because he knew the names and he knew what was going on. The reason I think he was killed was because he had inside information, firsthand information, about the drug smuggling operation that involved the Clintons, the Bushes, and the Israelis. That's why he was a danger to the system.
I'm speaking with investigative journalist and author Christopher Bolin. Today's show, Architects of Terror. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
You mentioned the little drummer girl. You write that John le Carré's 1983 novel, The Little Drummer Girl, is about Israeli false flag operations, and that in the preface to his book, John le Carré thanked past and serving officers of Israeli intelligence. I believe The Little Drummer Girl was also made into a movie. Yes, you mentioned this.
Right.
What is the storyline of The Little Drummer Girl, and what do you think is its significance?
Yeah, John le Carré signed the foreword to that book, or the preface, in I think it was July 1982. And that's exactly the time when the Israelis were invading Lebanon in 1982 under Ariel Sharon and Menachem Begin. But as he says in the very beginning, he thanks and he names these people. He names the former head of Israeli military intelligence for basically, giving him all this information and insight about how Israeli intelligence operations work in Europe. And in this book, and in the movie, I think it's Diane Keaton plays the role. She's an actress from England, and she's basically recruited by the Mossad to help entrap a Palestinian. And she goes down to Turkey or Greece and hooks up with this Palestinian guy, and they have sort of a relationship, a romance. But the whole purpose of the book is to implicate this Palestinian in terrorism that he, that he's not actually involved in. And in the movie, some of the scenes in the movie involve like Israelis blowing up a synagogue, but it's not really they're not really blowing up the synagogue. They're putting charges in the window and blowing the windows out. It's all theatrics. And that's one of the key statements in the book by one of the Mossadniks. He says that terror is theater. Theater's a con trick. Do you know what that means? Con trick? You've been deceived. And that's very important, to understand how the Israeli military intelligence goes about implicating and setting up a crime like this so that the authorities that do the investigation following the crime come away believing and thinking and having in their hands evidence that implicates, Arabs or terrorists or whatever, Palestinians, when in fact the whole thing has been basically theater. And that's what we're seeing now and much more in the United States. We're seeing these incidents like, San Bernardino and Boston Marathon. We're seeing terrorist attacks or terrorist incidents where clearly the public can see that we're being deceived. It's really the theater aspect of these crimes, of these terrorist attacks, is becoming very evident. So it's like the game is up. These people are still doing these terrorist attacks. They're still doing them on a daily basis in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. But when they do these kinds of crimes in this country, the public has woken up to the fact that we are being deceived, and that's a really good thing.
There was ultimately an unsuccessful attempt to obtain the security contract for the New York Port Authority back in 1987. Mm-hmm. Who obtained the security contract, and how did they lose it?
Well, that's a very interesting aspect of this crime. A couple Mossadniks, these are high-level Mossad agents. Zvi Malkin is one of them, and the other one is Avram Shalom Ben-Dor. These two men were very high-level Mossad agents working under Esther Harel, the first chief of the Mossad, and the first chief of the Shin Bet, basically. This is Israeli domestic intelligence and foreign intelligence. And Esther Harel, he employed terrorism in his operations. And that's one reason why he was forced to resign from the Mossad in 1963, because he was involved in an assassination tactic of killing German scientists called Operation Damocles, which was being run by Yitzhak Shamir. But the thing is that these two men, Zvi Malkin and Avram Shalom Ben-Dor, came to the United States in the 1980s, and these men had been involved in high-level Mossad operations, like the kidnapping of Adolf Eichmann down in Argentina, the former Nazi who was kidnapped, taken to Israel, you know, tried and hanged. And they were also involved in the illegal procurement of plutonium in this country and shipping it to Israel for its nuclear arsenal. So they were very high-level Mossad players, and they came to this country in the 80s. And in 1987, they actually obtained the security contract for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which was the body that owned the World Trade Center. And this is the agency that oversees the ports and the harbors and the airports and the bridges and tunnels of New York City and New Jersey. They obtained the security contract for the World Trade Center and the Port Authority, and this crime of 9/11 probably would have occurred in the late 80s or early 90s had not a person at the Port Authority discovered that Avram Shalom Ben-Dor was convicted of a murder in Israel and was using a false name. And this is the person who was the president of the security company that got the Port Authority contract. It was called Atwell Security of Tel Aviv. And it was actually a company that was set up by the big Mossad guy, Shaul Eisenberg, basically Mr. Asia for Israel. And when the Port Authority discovered that Avraham Shalom Ben-Dor was using a fake name and was wanted or was convicted of murder in Israel as the former chief of the Shin Bet, they tore up the contract. And as I said, had they not torn up the contract, 9/11 would have probably occurred in the late 80s or early 90s. But it was discovered, the contract was torn up, but that wasn't the end of the operation. What they then did is Avraham Shalom Ben-Dor went to work for Jules Krull. And Jules Krull and Maurice Greenberg, they had a company together called Krull Associates. And Krull Associates got the security contract for the World Trade Center after the bombing in 1993. So you see, using the offices of this American Jules Krull, the Mossad still got into the security contract for the World Trade Center. But it took them until 1993 to do so.
Well, then, what company or companies held the security contract for the World Trade Center on September 11th?
Well, it was Krull Associates. Krull Associates, headed by Jules Krull and his son, and then involving Maurice Greenberg and his son, they had the Krull Associates. They were given the duty to rewrite procedures, security procedures for the World Trade Center, and they did so. This is after the bombing in 1993. And the 1993 bombing in the basement was basically an FBI sting operation. And it was investigated for the city of New York, for the Robert Morgenthau, the DA of New York. It was investigated by a guy named Cherkasky. I think his name is Michael Cherkasky. And he was the head of investigations for New York City and for Robert Morgenthau. And then the following year, Mr. Cherkasky went to work for Krull Associates when they became the organization that was in charge of security for the World Trade Center. And the Port Authority took all of their recommendations and put them into effect. And this group, Krull Associates, then had the security contract for the World Trade Center and oversaw security for the World Trade Center all the way through to the destruction in 2001.
Could you explain the relationship of Krull Associates with Marsh and McLennan? Who are the people involved in these companies?
Well, it's Jules Krull and his business partner, Maurice Greenberg. also known as Hank Greenberg, who was the former CEO of AIG, the company that got the lion's share of the $180 billion bailout in 2008 and 2009. These two men have several companies together, and one of them is Marsh McLennan. And Marsh McLennan is the company into whose computer room the first plane struck. The very first plane went right into Marsh McLennan's secure computer center, which was in the North Tower. And Kroll Associates and Maurice Greenberg, they have several companies together. Maurice Greenberg has a whole bunch of, you know, operations with Jules Kroll. And their sons are also involved. Jules Kroll's son and Maurice Greenberg's son. Maurice Greenberg's son, for example, was the CEO of Marsh McLennan when the first plane struck their computer room. And this is very important because both planes actually struck secure computer rooms. And both computer rooms seem to have been prepared with thermite charges and things like that so that the explosion was, spectacular and pyrotechnical. But those are the people, those two characters, you know, Greenberg and Kroll, they're very important because Kroll Associates also involved people like Jerome Hauer. Jerome Hauer had been a Kroll associate, and he was the guy in San Diego who came on and said, you know, basically that this was the 9/11 was done by Osama bin Laden, and the towers fell because of the, you know, burning fuel. Another one was Paul Bremer, who was the first head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, I think it was called the CPA, in Iraq. He was basically America's proconsul to run the occupation of Iraq for the first 3 or 4 years, during which time, you know, there was no metering of the oil that was being exported from Iraq. All of these characters are at the highest level of the Iraqi invasion of Iraq, and 9/11. I mean, even Jerome Hauer, who was a Kroll Associates employee, was the person who put the Office of Emergency Management hard bunker on the 23rd floor of building number 7, you know, the building that fell down at 5:20 in the afternoon. So, I mean, these people are all connected. This small group of players are very deeply connected in the crimes of 9/11 and the atrocity of what happened on 9/11 and then the war in Iraq.
Do you think the high-tech enterprise architecture company P-TECH was compromised? You write that their enterprise software was used to provide real-time access and control of all data and information on government computer networks on September 11th.
Yes. This is also part of Indira Singh's contribution to 9/11 understanding. Yeah, P-TECH was more than compromised. P-TECH was basically an Israeli operation, and it was enterprise software based in Quincy, Massachusetts, and it was what I call like a false front operation in which people were led to believe that it was a Lebanese Muslim who had set up the company, and that this company had been sponsored by some dodgy Saudi guy who has some ties to terrorism. This is all part of the deception. In fact, the person who was playing the key role in the establishment of the company from the beginning in 1994 and getting its software, its enterprise software, onto U.S. military and government computers was a man named Michael Goff, a Jewish guy from Worcester, Massachusetts, who was a lawyer. And Michael Goff, what he did is that I spoke to him and I asked him how he wound up working for P-TECH. And he said that he had left his law practice in Worcester, Mass. He was working for a good company out there. And he left that law firm and went to work through an agency for P-TECH, which was a little startup company in 1994. And I asked him, well, what agency was that? What agency, you know, was responsible for your going? He couldn't remember. So I think he was not telling me the truth here. And what's interesting is that Michael Goff went on to work for the Mossad company Guardium, which is another computer software company, Guardium with an M at the end. And that's a very clearly an Israeli intelligence operation. So he's working on one hand for Israeli intelligence, and on the other hand, he's working for P-TECH, this dodgy little Arab startup company in Quincy, Mass., whose software finds itself onto all the computers in the United States government military. Well, you know, I think I pinned the tail on the donkey when I say that P-TECH was an Israeli intelligence front operation all along. And this is how This is how you do spying in the big, big picture. When you have enterprise software running on U.S. government computers, you know what's going on in the operation, in the computer network, whichever agency you're talking about. You have absolute control, surveillance operability, and control operability throughout the operation in real time. That is intelligence gathering at the highest level.
I'm speaking with investigative journalist and author Christopher Bolin. Today's show, Architects of Terror. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
9/11 whistleblower Indira Singh said that PTEC was with MITRE Corporation in the basement of the FAA for 2 years prior to 9/11. What do we know about MITRE Corporation?
Well, MITRE Corporation is based out of MIT originally, and it's part of Lincoln Labs, which is a company that does all of the the engineering, software engineering, and things like that for the U.S. Air Force. MITRE Corporation is a very big defense contractor. It's based outside Boston. And these two companies were involved, as she said, in the basement of the FAA, checking for and examining the relationship between the FAA and the military in the event of a crisis like 9/11. I've written a great deal about MITRE and PTEC and the people involved in this. And again, there's this very strong Zionist influence in MITRE. The former CEO and the people that ran it, James Schlesinger was in there. Rodney Schlesinger, I think, might be. But in any case, this whole operation was basically being done to prepare the understanding and to put the super users in charge of how the communication would flow from the FAA to the military when 9/11 occurred. And this is a very important part of the computer aspect of the crime, because as we now know, there was a drill going on that day, and the air traffic controllers were completely befuddled and didn't understand what was real and what was false that day. But also the communications between the FAA and the military were thwarted and delayed, so that there was no proper, effective military response to the hijackings. And this is not by accident. This is done by a very intelligent foe who has infiltrated the most important and sensitive computer networks involved in defense of this country. And that's where we have a very serious problem. You know, that the Israeli military intelligence has infiltrated the computer networks of the U.S. government and military, so that they have this super user access to these computer networks. And it went on. Even in later on, the NSA itself took encryption software from an Israeli company. And I called up the NSA and I said, I mean, how is it that the NSA, you're the signal intelligence of the United States of America, and you give your encryption software, you know, responsibility over to a foreign country? They had no problem with that, they said. But I mean, that just gives you an idea of how infiltrated our computer networks are. And it's the same thing what we found out later with this revelations by Snowden, and I think it was Assange, but the Snowden revelations revealed that in San Francisco, the companies that were involved, I think one was called Prism, another was called Narus, these two companies that were involved in the splitting of the rays and sending the data in real time directly to Israel were both Israeli companies. So what we find is that, you know, at the highest level and the computer networks in this country, military and government, they're completely infiltrated and controlled by Israeli intelligence. Even the cybersecurity czar for the Pentagon was a guy named Amit Yoran, and he's an Israeli, and he and his brother, you know, ran this network of hackers, friendly hackers, whatnot. But these are the people who wrote the security protocols for the Pentagon, for their security software. And he was the cybersecurity czar for the United States of America, and he's an Israeli citizen. You know, this is how bad it is.
What is the Site Intelligence Group? Who runs it, and what do they do? That's SITE.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very important. Site Intelligence Group is a Israeli intelligence website operation based in Bethesda, Maryland, And the front person for this organization is an Israeli intelligence agent named Rita Katz, K-A-T-Z. And she works out of Bethesda, Maryland. And what this group does is it provides the video feed coming from, for example, ISIS. One of their main clients or main subjects is this Islamic State group in Syria and Iraq. So when we see videos coming from this, supposedly coming from this ISIS group, what is coming to us through this Israeli intelligence website called Site Intelligence Group. And so what it basically means is that our understanding of this Islamic threat in Syria and Iraq called ISIS is most of the time primarily coming to us through these Israelis. And that's very important to understand. This is a good example of how U.S. military and U.S. media view the Middle East through Israeli spectacles, because they are the ones who are providing us with the so-called intelligence, the propaganda, the videos, what have you. And so it's very much like the wag the dog, you know, theme of the movie, in which videos are being provided to us from an Israeli website supposedly portraying this latest threat to, you know, peace in the Middle East. And that's very important to understand, because when, for example, the second video or the video of the second American being beheaded came to, you know, CNN and Fox News, it came from Site. And Site admitted on CNN that they had actually released, Site Intelligence Group had released the video before ISIS had released the video. And as Rita Katz said on CNN, well, this is because we had a copy of the video beforehand. Well, how did the Israeli intelligence have a copy of the video beforehand, before ISIS had actually released the video, unless they're inside the camera? This gives you an idea of how close Israeli intelligence is to this ISIS operation.
Let's talk about Hollywood and the movies. You write about several very important films, including The Medusa Touch of 1978, JFK, the cult classic Brazil, as well as the television pilot for The Lone Gunman. Mm-hmm. What makes these films significant, and who produced them?
Yeah, they're very important. Most of them are Israeli-produced films made by Arnon Milchan. And he's one of the big media moguls in Hollywood. He's an Israeli guy. He's a very high-level Israeli intelligence agent who's been involved in smuggling of equipment and nuclear triggers and things of that nature for Israel's nuclear arsenal. And in doing that, he was their chief agent in an Israeli operation called LAKAM, L-A-K-A-M, which was basically the operation to procure the essential elements needed for Israel's nuclear arsenal. And this was being run by Shimon Peres, of course, the godfather of Israel's nuclear arsenal. Their main agent was Arnon Milchan in Hollywood. So he was busted, for example. His operation was busted in 1985 for having smuggled something like 850 nuclear triggers for nuclear bombs to Israel. But when the operation was discovered, the triggers had already been sent to Israel. The only people who actually were busted or being sought by FBI were the American underlings. Arnon Milchan was not named in the investigation, although he was the one who ran the whole operation. Well, in 1978, before he even got involved in that smuggling operation for the triggers, he had made a movie in 1978 called The Medusa Touch, his first movie. And in this movie, it was an English-French production, a Boeing 747. The climactic scene is a Boeing 747 flying into the Pan Am building, or a high rise. It looks like the Pan Am building. And then later he made, in the year 2000, he, with his partner, Rupert Murdoch, they had a company called New Regency Films or New Regency Television, and they made a movie called The Pilot Episode of The Lone Gunman, in which a passenger aircraft was hijacked remotely and flown into the World Trade Center. And what this is ideation. This is putting the idea out there in the public domain that people are trying to hijack planes and fly them into the World Trade Center. And he was obviously aware of this plot. In 1978, when he made the movie, he was very close to the head of Israeli intelligence and the head of Israeli military as their Weizmann. So it's like his ideas, his themes of his movies didn't just come out of thin air. he's working from an understanding of what the plots are that are in the making.
And what about the cult classic Brazil? He was also the producer of that, wasn't he?
Yes. That was a film that was written by, I think, Terry Gilliam, the American guy involved in the comedy series on TV. It was a big comedy series, and Terry Gilliam wrote the script for this movie. And what's interesting, it came out in like 1985, and in the movie, it's a grim futuristic piece about life in the future, in which terrorism occurs on a daily basis all around these people. And, for example, they'll be at a restaurant and a bomb will go off, and then the waiters come out and bring up a screen, set up the screen. And the background of the whole theme, I think Robert De Niro plays the key role. The background is that the society is at war with the terrorists. There's this ongoing war against terrorism, and the terrorists occasionally put bombs off, you know, here and there. And it's like terrorism became a way of life, and the war on terror was the war that these people were involved in. It's uncanny because it's so close to what we now see happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, these two countries that were the first battlefields of the war on terror. And these two countries, now 14 years after the beginning of the war on terror, now have more terrorism and more deaths due to terrorism than any time in their history. It's worse now in the last year in both those countries than it's ever been. So you can see that the war on terrorism has been extremely expensive and extremely counterproductive, because rather than eliminating terrorism, it has increased terrorism like 10 times. And so last year in Afghanistan, there was a record number of people killed due to terrorism, and likewise in Iraq.
Now, this Arnon Milchan was also the producer of the film JFK, isn't that right?
That's right. That's right. And in that film, of course, the viewer comes away thinking that there's this nebulous group in the U.S. CIA that's responsible for the death of the president. And it's a good film. It's made by Oliver Stone. But there is, of course, no discussion or no presentation of any of the Israeli involvement in the murder of John F. Kennedy. For example, you know, we know now, thanks to Leah Rabin, who wrote a memoir after the death of her husband, that her husband, Yitzhak Rabin, was in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. And she said that, you know, it was just a coincidence, she said. But also, as soon as he went back to Israel in December of that year, 1963, he was made chief of staff. So whatever he did in Dallas apparently was rewarded with the highest position in the Israeli military.
I'm speaking with investigative journalist and author Christopher Bolin. Today's show, Architects of Terror. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Who was the head of Israeli intelligence that predicted in 1980 that Arab terrorists would attack this tallest building in New York City? What can you tell us about this prediction?
Oh, that's very interesting. That's Yisr Harel. That was the founding chief of the Mossad and of the Shin Bet, Israeli domestic and foreign intelligence. And Yisr Harel was the one who, as I said, was removed from his position at Mossad in 1963 because of his operation to kill German scientists who had been working with Egypt. And in that operation, Yitzhak Shamir was the main guy running the operation, the murder operation. But Yisr Harel was interviewed by a guy named Michael Evans. I think his name was Michael Evans. And this is a Jewish guy from Texas who has a Christian evangelist, Christian Zionist outfit called Jerusalem Prayer Team, I think it's called. Well, in any case, this guy, this Michael Evans, has very close connections to the extreme right wing in Israel, the Likud party, Menachem Begin, and the head of the former head of the Mossad. And in 1980, he reported this, you know, later. In 1980, he was having dinner with Yisr Harel, the former head of the Mossad, and he asked him, do you think terrorism will ever come to the United States? And if so, where? And Yisr Harel told him, yes, I think it will, and they will attack your tallest building in New York City. And they'll attack the tallest building because that's a symbol of your power and your fertility and all that kind of stuff. And he said that that's what they'll do. And lo and behold, you know, 21 years later, that came true. And this prediction was made in 1979 and again in 1980. This is when it was reported by Michael Evans. So clearly the plotting, the planning, the Israeli planning for the 9/11 terror attacks went into high gear in the late 1970s. And this is exactly the time, 1977, when the Likud coalition came to power in Israel. And the Likud coalition is very important to understand. This is the coalition of the former heads of the terrorist outfits in Palestine, Israel, from the 1930s and 40s. This is Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Shamir, Ariel Sharon. This is the most radical, ruthless, and extremist elements of the Zionist movement. This is basically the Jabotinsky Zionists, and they involve the Netanyahu family and the Begin family and the Shamir family. These are really, really extreme people. And that's not appreciated by people in America, because Americans basically don't have the understanding or the historical understanding of Zionism and the different elements of Zionism.
Now, these terrorist groups that you're mentioning would have been what? Irgun and also the Stern Group?
Yeah, there was two of the biggest ones were the Irgun, that was under Menachem Begin, and the Stern Gang, or Lehi, and that was under Yitzhak Shamir. And the heads of these two groups came together, as I said, in 1973, formed the Likud coalition, and then they came to power in 1977. And they have basically been in power ever since. At certain times, they've had to share power with the other parties, but they have prevailed. They have been the most powerful ruling party in Israeli politics since the late 1970s. And that's very important to understand, because these are the people who have always used terrorism as their modus operandi.
You had a quote from Menachem Begin, actually. Somebody asked him about being the biggest terrorist in the Middle East. What did he say?
Yeah, that's interesting. That was in 1974. I think that it was a British journalist named Russell Howe. And he was asked, how does it feel in light of all that's going on in 1974 to be considered the father of terrorism in the Middle East? And Begin kind of chuckled and said, in the Middle East, in all the world. And so he was taking upon himself the mantle of being the father of terrorism in all the world. And, you know, the truth be known, that's not a far cry from the truth. The Israelis are the ones who have made terrorism, you know, what it is today. And they have played a key role in a great deal of it. You know, and what we've seen in Iraq, for example, that some of these terrorists, when you unwrap their turbans and find their identity, is that they're not Iraqi or Afghani at all. They're in some cases, you know, Israeli or British intelligence agents. And that's very important to understand, because then we're not dealing with a real threat. We're dealing with an artificial threat. We're dealing with a fake terrorism. And that's what's really important to understand, is to understand that 9/11 and most of the terrorism that goes on in this world today is in fact fake terrorism or contrived terrorism, false flag terrorism, and that the war on terror, which is what 9/11 was meant to start, is equally a fraud. So that we're living in deceived times, and that the war on terror and the terrorism that we see happening around us is all part of basically a big theater operation, a big psyops. And so when we understand that, we can disabuse ourselves of this notion that we're fighting a war against Islam and the whole Arab world, what have you. No, we're being duped. We're being deceived on a day-to-day basis. And the sooner we understand that, the quicker we'll pull ourselves out of this Zionist war agenda that is destructive of this country and much of the world. You know, it's interesting that the war on terrorism was first articulated in the late 1970s, again, the late 1970s, by Netanyahu himself at the Jerusalem conference in 1979 of the Netanyahu Institute. And Netanyahu had been an employee of the Rothschild in the years prior to this conference. And at the conference, George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, spoke in support of this idea. But the Israeli idea was to get the United States into the Middle East on a war footing to fight the terror groups, what you would call these resistance groups, who were opposed to Israeli occupation and hegemony in the region. So that's where we find ourselves now. We are now camped out in the Middle East on a permanent basis, fighting an Israeli, a Zionist war agenda for them. So there is really no American interest whatsoever. We've been completely tricked into a fraudulent war.
Israelis in the Twin Towers were forewarned about the attacks of September 11th. Isn't that right?
Oh, yes, they were. But what happened is that there was a Israeli instant messaging service called Odigo. And this company had their corporate offices two blocks from the World Trade Center. And their research and development, the operations, was being done in Herzliya, Israel. You know, this is the typical of these Israeli companies I was telling you about. And a couple hours before 9/11, before the first plane struck at, 8:45, a couple hours before that, there was a warning message that went out on this Odigo instant messaging system. And if you were an Odigo subscriber, you would get the message through your BlackBerry or your internet or your email, whatever platform you used, you would get this message. And the message said that there would be something disastrous happening at the World Trade Center. And as the vice president of the company later said, the warning was precise to the minute. So this, in conjunction with the fact that something like 4,000 Israelis were expected to have been in the area of the World Trade Center or the Pentagon on 9/11, and that of these 4,000, basically four Israelis perished, indicates to me that most of the people that got the Odigo message stayed away.
In his run for the Republican nomination, Donald Trump has cited an instance of Arab nationals, or maybe he said Muslims, seen celebrating in New York City as the World Trade Center towers exploded. Who, in fact, were these celebrants?
Yeah, this is a very odd thing, because he's putting, again, Arabs, he's blaming Arabs for something that turned out to be Israelis. There were indeed five Middle Eastern men who had been seen celebrating the attack on the World Trade Center and clicking their lighters and giving high fives on the Jersey side of the river there. But this was reported by Ted Koppel at about noon on 9/11, and he said they were Middle Eastern men. But these five Middle Eastern men turned out to be Israeli agents. So they were the Kurtzberg brothers and then three other operatives. And these men were arrested by New Jersey police in the afternoon on 9/11, and they were found to have been carrying box cutters and thousands of dollars stuck in their socks and things like that. And their van tested positive for explosives. But when it was then turned over to the FBI, and these men were held in detention in Brooklyn for about 2 months, and then they went back to Israel, and they appeared on the Yair Lapid show. And in that show, the three operatives admitted that they had been on a mission, and the purpose of their mission was to document the event. And all five of these characters were affiliated with, connected with a company called Urban Moving Systems in Weehawken, New Jersey, which we now know was an Israeli Mossad front company, to look like a moving company, but it was basically there to set up the 9/11 operation.
In your powerful two-hour presentation at the Presidio Library in San Francisco, you had a slide of the September 11th memorial at Ground Zero in New York City. There was a design contest for this memorial. Whose design won?
Yeah, it's very interesting that the memorial with the pools and the falling water was designed by an Israeli man named Michael Arad. And Michael Arad is the son of Moshe Arad. And Moshe Arad was the former Israeli ambassador to the United States. And the Arad family is very close to the Netanyahus. So what's interesting is that the legacy, both the museum and the memorial, were designed by an Israeli designer who is connected to basically the godfather of the war on terror, Netanyahu. It's Michael Arad. A-R-A-D.
One thing I didn't realize until you pointed it out is that Larry Silverstein and Benjamin Netanyahu have a very close friendship. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Benjamin Netanyahu and Larry Silverstein had a weekly conversation on the telephone every Sunday afternoon for years prior to 9/11. So that means that Netanyahu is basically the godfather of the war on terror, spoke every Sunday afternoon with Larry Silverstein, who was basically the godfather of the 9/11 destruction. I mean, all three towers that fell that day belonged to Larry Silverstein. And, you know, these two men, wherever they were in the world, every Sunday afternoon, they would have a discussion on the telephone. And this was reported by an Israeli reporter, and this was published in November 2001 in the Israeli media. And that's very interesting, because what were they talking about? You know, these men were having this weekly conversation. And obviously, you know, these two men are the key players in the war on terror and 9/11. And it's interesting to note that Larry Silverstein basically was the recipient of the World Trade Center in late July, July 24th, I think it was, 2001, in which these public buildings, these publicly owned buildings, became his private property, at least to the extent that he was able to insure them against an act of terrorism. So when these publicly owned buildings became private property and he insured them, he then became the recipient of something like $7.5 billion when they were destroyed.
Christopher Bolin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's been a pleasure being with you.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Christopher Bolin. Today's show has been Architects of Terror. Christopher Bolin is an independent researcher, investigative journalist, and author. He has lived and traveled extensively throughout the world, including the Middle East, where he studied the region's history and languages before earning a degree in history from the University of California with an emphasis on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Along with research and writing, he has worked as an editor and translator. He is the author of Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and Solving 9/11, The Articles. Visit his website at bolin.com. That's bolin.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaro Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now, the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall.
As few other poets have done, Robert Bly has changed the world for all who now share it, insists poet Jane Hirschfield. Ample proof is luminously shown in the sparkling new feature-length film by Hayden Reese, A Thousand Years of Joy, the life of author, poet, translator, activist, cultural troublemaker, Robert Bly. Hayden Reese, who also made Rumi, Poet of the Heart, will present the East Bay premiere in person on Wednesday evening, April 6th, at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 2286 Cedar Street. This KPFA benefit has wheelchair access, tickets at supportive indie bookstores, and brownpapertickets.com for April 6th, when you can enjoy, yes, a thousand years of joy.
This is Dennis Bernstein, host of Flashpoints.
This is Miguel Gavilan Molina, host and senior producer of Flashpoints.
Heard on KPFA every weekday from 5 to 6.
Flashpoints is a hard-hitting news magazine that monitors the centers of power and reports back to the people.
We bring community radio into the community and give voice to the voiceless, from occupied Palestine to the falsely accused on death row.
From the brown revolutions in the fields of misery to the front lines of the new labor and civil rights movement.
On Flashpoints, black and brown lives really do matter. So join us here on KPFA every weekday at 5 p.m. Thank you.
And it is 2 o'clock here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5